to B&Q, Big Nerdy Questions, and tonight we are going back to the United Federation of Planets, the final frontier, and I am so thrilled to be going back to the land of Star Trek, and of course with me, Josh P., welcome back, my Star Trek buddy.
You know, just for my contribution for this episode, I plan to keep account of how many times we accidentally say Kardashian instead of Cardassian.
We will probably slip up, especially with Chain of Command, which we'll get to in a little bit. But we have a special guest tonight, Josh, don't we? One of my podcasting heroes, the man behind the Starbase 66 podcast, the Seventh Chevron, the Floridian ambassador of Simply Syndicated, Admiral Marius. Rick, welcome to Big Nerdy Question.
Yeah, no pressure there. Thanks, dude. Thank you very much. I'm glad I don't have a camera hooked up because I'm probably about 15 shades of red. But that's very, very, very generous of you. Thank you.
Well, 50 Shades of Red is the BDSM novel for Star Trek security officer.
Yeah, it's only 2 pages long though.
Yeah.
All right, I've got a question for you before we go any further.
Yeah.
All right. Ned Stark can't pick up the hammer, but freaking SpongeBob can.
That's him. Josh?
I take it that's directed at me. For the record, I never said Ned Stark couldn't.
No, that was Matt. Matt made that call. Matt is our Game of Thrones guy. And he was convinced that Ned couldn't because he said that Ned wasn't a warrior in combat. I don't think I buy that, but I'm sure he has a reason for why he said that. But I do think SpongeBob doesn't know that he shouldn't.
It's true. Okay.
Kind of like Vision.
Yeah, pretty much. But tonight's topic, I should introduce. Last time we focused on the movies, and tonight we're focusing on The Next Generation. In fact, we're focusing on a certain specific set of episodes, the two-parters. As all of you Trek fans know, the original series only had one two-part episode, The Menagerie, which was a way to reuse footage from the unaired pilot, The Cage. DS9... became essentially one continuous episode by season 7, so it's not fair to really look at the two-parters. And we'll talk about Voyager and Enterprise if we ever have the time, hint, hint. But Next Generation two-parters, a lot of them are iconic. Maybe some of them shouldn't be. Maybe some of them ought to be more revered than others. I was inspired to choose this topic because when Star Trek The Next Generation went off the air, Jonathan Frakes hosted a special on the inside the universe of The Next Generation, and they had a fan poll in 1994 of the top 5 TNG episodes. The top 5 were Relics with Scotty, mm-hmm. Yesterday's Enterprise, The Inner
yep.
Light,
yep,
and the top 2 were Best of Both Worlds Part 1 and Part 2. And that was, of course, when this show went off the air in 94. That was, and by the way, that special aired before All Good Things, which we are considering in this episode. So now that we've had quite a bit of time since 94, does Best of Both Worlds still the best of the two-parters, if not the series, or are some of the other two-parters more worthy of our acclaim? Before we get into the meat of our discussion, though, Matt is not here, so we don't have any sponsors tonight. We do have a real sponsor, of course. Please check out Dragon Fruit, the dating app made by geeks for geeks, at dragonfruitapp.com, or search Dragon Fruit in the App Store or in the Google Play Store. You've heard Ori on the show before, and you know he made a great product. It's completely free. So if you're looking for the one to commence ponfar with, please consult the Dragon Fruit app. And we have a big nerdy recommendation tonight, and it's coming from our special guest. So, Rick, what would you like to recommend?
I would like to recommend a book that I just finished, actually, about an hour ago. I don't know how you guys feel about audiobooks. Do you consider that having read a book?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I just finished reading/listening to a book called The 50-Year Mission by Edward Gross and Mark A. Altman. It's the unauthorized oral history of Star Trek. It's actually two books. I just finished the first 25 years, which is 22 hours of book. There's a little bit of narration in there, but 99% of the book is direct quotes from people involved in making Star Trek, arranged chronologically throughout the genesis and creation of the entire series up through Star Trek VI. The second half picks up with the beginning of The Next Generation. I got it on Audible, and I was a little hesitant on it because I considered myself pretty steeped in TOS lore and, you know, how things went and how things were made, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's been numerous books and documentaries and stuff, but there was a lot of stuff in there I did not realize from the horse's mouth quotes and things. That's just a lot of it's really eye opening. And I strongly recommend it. If you're a Trek fan, if you're interested in the behind the scenes stuff, check it out. It is quite amazing. I would say that it probably is better as an audiobook, even though it's actors reading the quotes. It's not the actual people. It still kind of lends it more life, I felt, by listening to it than by reading it.
Well, I can say oral histories are always interesting to listen to, and I'm sure I would love this. I recently watched on Netflix a documentary that Shatner helped produce about the beginnings of the Next Gen.
I saw that too. Was it called Trouble on the Bridge? Something like
yes,
that?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
We talked about that one on the Simply Syndicated Movie News. It's an interesting documentary. I think it's a little bit biased against Roddenberry.
Absolutely it is, yeah.
I try not to be a Roddenberry apologist because the man definitely had his mercenary side. But that documentary really seems to go hard and heavy on the Roddenberry bashing.
Yeah, I agree. You know, but we will check out your recommendation, absolutely, the 50-year mission. I would personally hope to hear some quotes from DC Fontana. I've always been interested in her perspective on the show, being the female writer that was so influential, such an interesting story to tell. I actually think that her life should be made into a Hollywood feature film, you know, being a head writer or one of the head writers on a science fiction program that was so groundbreaking would be a great show to watch anyway. So
I'd watch that.
Thank you for your recommendation, Rick, by the way.
My pleasure.
We will definitely check that out. And it's now time for us to move into our discussion of the two-part episodes of The Next Generation. And a quick note, as I alluded to earlier with All Good Things, we are going to include Encounter at Farpoint and All Good Things as eligible in this episode, even though they both aired originally as uncut two-hour episodes, because when they run in syndication, they are treated as two different episodes. Netflix, they're treated as one, but it's clearly a double-length episode. Purposes of this episode, they'll be counted as a two-parter because that's how they are watched on television if you ever see them aired today. So we're going to go chronologically through the two-parters and talk about the pros and cons of each episode. Some episodes we'll have more to talk about and some will have less, undoubtedly. And at the end of the episode, as is B&Q tradition, the three of us will attempt to come to a consensus on what is the best two-parter of The Next Generation. With no further ado, that means we are going to start at the very beginning. We're going to encounter at Farpoint. Ha, ha, ha. I'll just open the floor with this comment. Encounter at Farpoint is not a bad introduction to the show. Clearly not. But you can tell that it is a hybrid of two different stories mashed together. The story of Q and the Trial of Humanity and the story of the secret at Farpoint Station. They do end up going together, but they don't necessarily have to.
They originally weren't intended to.
No, they weren't. And Q is incidental to the resolving the plot at Farpoint Station. But I will say, the plot at Farpoint sets the tone for the entire Next Gen series because it's a problem solved through creative thinking and science as opposed to a fight, which is more of the Next Gen model than the original series. Rick, what are your thoughts on Encounter at Farpoint? I'm sure you probably watched it when it aired and have some more thoughts on it than we might.
Yeah, in case you don't know, I'm old as dirt. So I was one of the original series fans who, when they announced that they were doing a new Star Trek show without Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, I was, hell no, this will never work. It's a terrible idea, you know, rabble, 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 arg, arg, arg. And then when Encounter at Farpoint came out, I watched it the night it aired, and I felt vindicated. I was like, this is terrible. This will never last. We were right. Don't try to mess with our Star Trek. Looking back on it now, as I have long since changed my tune about TNG, although the first two seasons are still really, really painful.
They're tough. I mean, there are a few exceptions like Measure of a Man.
Oh, well, yeah. Measure of a Man. Actually, I've recently been rewatching TNG to go along with another podcast I listened to. And I actually found that seasons 1 and 2 are not as bad as I remembered them being. And Encounter at Farpoint, it's like if people ask me, should like a new Trek you know, someone new to the series watch it? And I say, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a deeply flawed show. The actors, for the most part, have no idea what they're doing with their characters yet. You know, Picard yelling, "Turn that damn noise off," and stuff like that. When you look back at it now, it just seems so bizarre. But it's an excellent introduction to the cast, to the new ship, to the new ethos of, like you said, of, you know, instead of, you know, we come in peace, shoot to kill, it's let's talk to this thing and figure out what's going on. I don't think it succeeds very well in portraying that. And I think if TNG had premiered today with that first season, we wouldn't be talking about it 25 years later. You definitely have to watch Encounter at Farpoint. It introduced it. So much of it carries out through the rest of the show, especially the Q stuff. And John DeLancey was the one exception to, you know, he was on point from the get-go. He knew who he was. He knew what he was doing with Q, and he just chewed the scenery all apart, and he's a joy to watch no matter what he's doing.
It almost feels like the Q character knew what he was doing because he's Q, and how could he not?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll get to All Good Things later, but you're right. The Q, that's maybe the most important storyline that the whole episode sets up, is the beginnings of the relationship between Q and the crew, but particularly Q and Picard. That we revisit. I think we revisit it once a season with the exception of one. But we pretty much have Q as a mainstay throughout the series.
Yep.
And Voyager as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much on DS9. He showed up once, Sisko punched him, and he never came back.
Yeah.
I'd never come back if I got punched by Sisko either.
No. And this is pre-bearded Sisko. If he came back with bearded Sisko, he would have been knocked out forever.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Q that killed himself in Voyager.
That exchange was one of the best exchanges with anyone with Q. You know, Picard never hit me.
I'm not Picard. There are some things in Encounter at Farpoint that make the Trekkie and me giddy. The first saucer separation is a thing to behold. In much the same way as the tour of the ship in the motion picture. Brilliant to watch. Still holds up today. The model work is magnificent.
Yes, I will grant you that. Now, I have to admit, I have never been a fan of the outboard design of the Galaxy class. I think it looks like a Macy's Thanksgiving Day balloon. I've never really been a fan of it.
I have rose-tinted glasses because it was my first Enterprise.
Yeah, yeah. I may be tainted by my initial displeasure with them redoing the show. But I have liked, like, I love the Ambassador class, Enterprise C. So I've mellowed on it, but I never was able to develop a liking for the Galaxy class.
I actually have a model of the Enterprise E.
Sovereign class isn't bad.
I also have the Galaxy class ship, but it's a 1994 commemorative snow globe from the end of the show. It still works. It lights up and has the theme song, which is nice. But yeah, there's definitely some good elements there, but a lot of it is flawed, I think. Josh, what's your take on Encounter at Farpoint?
The introduction of Q was spot on. An interesting side note, this episode was going to be about who is the best villain in Star Trek The Next Generation, but there's clearly no contest there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad you changed the topic for that one, Josh.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as someone who got its start with The Next Generation and did not know much about the original series before getting into it, I actually appreciate the history lesson that's taught in Encounter at Farpoint.
That's a good point, especially when McCoy shows up.
Right.
That whole thing brings me to tears every time I watch it.
In a good way or a bad way?
No, in a great way. When he's, you know, okay, you got a good ship here, you treat her right and she'll away. I get choked up just saying it.
Yeah. You remind me of that Vulcan.
I don't see no points on them ears.
The makeup they did with D. Kelly, too, it's like it's a shame that he didn't get to live to be nearly 200 years old.
Yeah, he looked to be older than the professor from Futurama.
If somebody wanted to cosplay as McCoy in Encounter at Farpoint, people probably would think he was the professor of Futurama.
Good news, everyone.
Okay, now I want to see a Futurama Trek crossover, although I'm sure that... They did one in Futurama, yeah.
Oh, the other way around, okay.
The other way around. Like, a real-life Bender shows up on the Enterprise holodeck to wreak havoc. He's Moriarty's newest creation.
I'd watch that.
A steampunk Bender. I could just imagine Geordi like making some really random comment about Bender's fusion core, and then Bender's like, "Bite my shiny metal ass" or something.
I'm really sorry for what I've done to this episode already.
Well, I do want to point out another technological innovation. This is the first time anyone ever saw the holodeck.
Well, not exactly.
No?
There was a holodeck analog in the animated series.
Oh, you're right. Of course you're right. I had forgotten that. This is the first time you have a live-action holodeck.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if we want to get into the... Well, we probably don't want to get into the is the animated series canon or not debate.
but, we debated that yesteryear. No.
Well done.
Thank you. I would think it would be... I think it's treated as such. It's the first time the holodeck is used in a live-action series, and it's definitely a concept that you could argue TNG used it to a point, maybe overused it in certain episodes, like A Fistful of Datas.
Yeah.
But the holodeck did make for some interesting scenarios, like the Big Goodbye. Then the Dixon Hill program, no matter, it's campy as hell, but it's iconic, as is Data's Sherlock Holmes program.
Of course.
So there are certainly, and then of course, the Hollow Pursuits, which introduces Barclay. So there are some good ways to use the holodeck. And I think one of the most underrated holodeck scenes is actually in Schisms, where they recreate the nightmare table with the scissors over it and the clicking sounds in the background. It's
yeah, that was one of their creepiest episode, probably.
Absolutely. I think what I'm hearing from all three of us is this episode is important. It influences the show, but on its own, it's certainly not going to be in contention for best two-parter.
I would concur with that.
I agree.
I think we can maybe do a discussion down the road in another episode on pilots in general in Star Trek, because there's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah.
But I think we can move on from Encounter and Farpoint. It is really its own animal. And by the time we get to the next two-parter, the show has found its footing, and boy howdy has it, because the next two-parter is the best of both worlds. The aforementioned best episode in the series, according to the fan poll in 1994. As a reminder for people who don't know show titles, because not all of you are as nerdy / geeky as the three of us. The Best of Both Worlds is the cliffhanger between season 3 and season 4, wherein the Borg have come back after their first appearance in Q-Who, Q again, introducing an enemy, and they are on a direct course for Sector 001, the Terran system. Insert dramatic music here.
Dun, dun, dun.
In so doing, they encounter the Enterprise and hail Captain Picard by name. And it turns out that they're no longer interested in just technology. They're interested in people, too. And the first person they want is Jean-Luc Picard, because they're going to start at the top. He's the LeBron James of the Trek draft. So they take Jean-Luc Picard on board and they assimilate him, although the term assimilation doesn't exist yet, at least not officially, and turn him into Locutus of Borg, setting up the cliffhanger at the end of part one, where Picard, as a Borg, is attacking the Enterprise. The Enterprise, Geordi and Data have just finished a deflector dish weapon that is going to blow up the Borg cube and simultaneously short-circuit the Enterprise. And despite protestations from Lieutenant Commander Shelby, Riker says, "Mr. Worf, fire." To Be Continued comes up, and fans everywhere have their first heart palpitation. People have said that not even just Star Trek, but in television history, this is one of the most iconic and tense cliffhangers ever written.
I would not disagree with that at all.
And the music helps it, certainly, but then you get to part two. Josh, what are your thoughts on Best of Both Worlds?
Well, going back to your comment about the cliffhanger, I'm glad we have Rick here who can probably describe what that was like, having to wait until next season. But I just want to say I was sitting with my wife watching this to study up for this episode, and I had tried to make a rule where I was going to wait until at least the next day to see part two of every episode that I saw, and she would not let me wait until part two for that specific one. Every other one I was allowed to do that if I wanted to, but she would not let me wait until the next day. We had to see what happened after Riker said fire.
And I believe for our listeners in the UK, like Richard Smith, I believe there was a even longer hiatus. I think TNG went off the air for almost a year. So imagine how bad it was for those of us here on this side of the pond. It was even worse elsewhere. I mean, can you imagine waiting that long? It's like when you're a Doctor Who fan. Oh, wait. Rick, how was it when this cliffhanger happened?
Season 3 was when I finally got pulled into Next Gen. Once I stopped hating on Next Gen, I just, you know, I completely fell in love with it. And, you know, yes, this was, what was it,
1990, I think.
90, yeah. So this is back in the days of, you know, there's no internet, there's no, you know, VHS is just kind of getting a foothold. And so you watch things when they were on TV. Now, TNG was unusual because it went on the air syndicated. So it wasn't like you would tune into NBC, you know, every week and watch it. But it was still, most stations only aired it one night a week. And I still remember I was living in Jacksonville, Florida. And I remember watching Best of Both Worlds, and, you know, we had no idea whether this was the end of Picard or not. There was, you know, there had been some rumors that maybe Patrick Stewart was leaving. And so he gets captured, he gets assimilated. Riker says, "Fire, to be continued," comes up, and I was alone in the house, and I just started throwing things and yelling.
That was going to be another one of my questions, was whether or not there was some legitimate worry that Patrick Stewart was going to leave the show.
There was. Now, whether or not those were stories planted by Paramount at the time. I never did find out, but there had been rumblings that maybe a major character was going to leave the show. So, you know, usually, you know, this was long before George R. R. Martin and, you know, Walking Dead and stuff. But, you know, usually if someone's name appeared in the credits before the, you know, during the opening credits, you know, they were fairly safe. But we didn't know.
Well, and TNG had, to their credit, I mean, not by choice, but they had killed off Tasha Yar. Mm-hmm. So the precedent had been set that a regular could go.
Okay, what's happening next week? Rerun of episode 1 of the season. You know, we had to wait until September, and this aired in mid-June.
I think that in the secret sauce and what making the cliffhanger so plausible is the storyline, the B-plot, if you will, of Riker having his last chance to take the captain's chair on the Melbourne, because the whole episode is setting up for Shelby saying Riker's in my way, Riker saying I'm ready, but I don't want to leave the ship. And you have the foreshadowing, I know that's never said outright, that the only captain's chair he wants is that of the Enterprise.
Yep. Yep.
He never says it, but the foreshadowing is expertly placed. So the minute Picard leaves and Riker takes command, you're thinking, well, it's not implausible for Riker to take command of this ship. It makes sense. And honestly, the first time I had watched Part 2, I had actually seen other episodes. I mean, I was still really young, so I wasn't watching it every week. So I had seen later episodes, so I knew Picard was going to live somehow. I suspended my disbelief when Riker puts on the fourth pip in Part 2 and actually is referred to as Captain Riker. I'm like, okay, maybe Picard comes back later down the line and later in the season, but Riker's the captain now. I bought it. I thought that there's no way Picard... Maybe Picard becomes the series villain for a while. I don't know. But well done to the TNG writing crew for putting that plotline in this episode. It made the cliffhanger that much better, in my opinion.
I don't disagree.
There has been some criticism of Best of Both Worlds that says that Part 2, and specifically the way the Borg are defeated, does not live up to the gravitas of Part 1. Rick, would you say that is a justified criticism or misses the mark?
No, I absolutely agree with that. In fact, that was a point I was going to bring up. The only problem I have with Best of Both Worlds, and I may be tipping my hand a little bit here, but why it's not at the top of my list, is because Part 2 does not live up to the promise of Part 1. Now, I think it could be fairly argued that it is impossible for a Part 2 to live up to Part 1. It wasn't like they wrote this as one whole story and then broke it into two parts. They wrote Part 1, and then the writers were all sitting around going, all right, what do we do now? And that is kind of, that kind of shows.
They didn't have the end game in mind.
Exactly. Exactly. And while I still enjoy the episode, I still think Part 2 is great. It's just a little bit disappointing. You know, I still love to watch it, but it would not be unusual for me to watch Part 1 and then not rewatch part two at that time.
Yeah, I've seen part one probably at least three more times than I've seen part two. Mm-hmm. I mean, the music of part one is amazing. The atmosphere, the tension, it's a masterclass of tension building. Part two is a good TNG episode, but it can't live up to part one. There's definitely an uneven. And the sad thing is, season four is probably the most consistently good season of the whole run. But part two isn't as good as part one.
Yeah, yeah. On its own, it's a perfectly good episode.
Exactly.
But as the closure of that just amazing part one. But you know what? In defense of the writers, it's a lot easier to create a situation and a cliffhanger than it is to find a satisfying denouement for it.
I mentioned Doctor Who earlier. I think that they've suffered from that problem a lot in recent years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a perfect building of a situation, but a lackadaisical conclusion to it. And I think I can point to The Wedding of River Song as an ideal example of this. The storyline building all season was great. The finale, not so much. But it is definitely more difficult to create the perfect denouement than to create the tension in the first place. And Josh, I know, you know, we actually had an episode earlier, Matt and I did, on the what supervillain scheme really should have worked. And Matt and I agreed that this episode, the Borg scheme, should have worked.
100%.
And the sleep thing is something they probably could have easily, as adaptable as the Borg are, they should have fixed it and tried it again. Because it's the only way they were stopped. And why in First Contact they had to resort to time travel when they could have done the same thing? It seems a bit odd. Do you agree?
I do agree. The Borg plan was too perfect in this episode, and they essentially lost on a fluke. If they just gone back to it again, but you know, closed the door, it would have worked.
Well, this is to continue with the Doctor Who comparison. The Borg were very much like the Weeping Angels in that when they're used as very sparingly and you don't see a whole lot about them, they're scary as hell and they're a great villain. But the more we learned about the Borg and the more they used them and the more convoluted they had to make the way they were defeated because they were just too strong. That, you know, nobody should have ever beaten the Borg, and especially in Voyager, where it just became more and more contrived for ways for Janeway to defeat the Borg.
In Matrix Zero.
don't get me started.
Yeah, I often wonder how the show would have been different if they would have gone with Plan A for the Borg to make them the insect creatures referenced in Conspiracy. I wonder how that would have turned out compared to the cyborg that they went with.
I still think they should have made the Ferengi the big bad that they...
Well, didn't they intend on making the Ferengi the big bad?
Yeah, I can't even say that with a straight face. The original intention for the Ferengi was, you know, Roddenberry was like, we don't want Klingons, we don't want Romulans, we want something new. And that's what the Ferengi were supposed to be, the big bad for Next Gen. And after that first episode, The Last Outpost, they were just so ridiculous that they all realized this is not going to work. And that's when they came up with the Borg.
I mean, honestly, the Cardassians are probably the best villain that Next Gen generated as far as the depth of the race, which we get to more in DS9.
Oh man, yeah. Love them.
I mean, the depth of that of them, and essentially the whole Nazi relationship, or essentially with Bajor, that we explore in TNG and then much more in DS9. That's an ingenious villain creation because they have their weaknesses. They're not an unbeatable villain, but they're still pretty darn hard to beat.
And they're also not unredeemably evil either.
No.
True.
Even someone as evil as Dukat has his moments where you sympathize with him.
Oh, Dukat is one of the greatest characters of in all of Star Trek.
Yes. Mark Alamo does not get enough credit for how he portrayed that man. That is what a performance. But DS9 was full of those kind of performances. It wouldn't have worked without those kind of in-depth character performances, mm-hmm. The way they structured the show. Best of both worlds. Right now, we have to put it aside. I think we'll get back to it in the discussion at the end. But yeah, it's definitely iconic, but there may be something that can surpass it. The next two-parter is the end of Season 4 into Season 5. It is Redemption. This is a Worf episode. And in fact, Worf shows up quite often in these two-parters. But this is a Worf episode where we are trying to restore the honor of the House of Moog, and at the same time, they're dealing with the succession in the Klingon High Council to install a new Chancellor, Gowron. And essentially in this episode, what you get is Worf resigning from Starfleet, joining his brother Kern in an effort to prop Gowron up against the House of Duras, led by Lursa and Betor, who've introduced a teenage boy as the rightful heir of Duras to the Council. Picard saying that he won't get the Federation involved, but he will have to if the Romulans are involved, which they are. We have the introduction of Sela as the first time we see Denise Crosby playing the role that she played a couple times on The Next Generation. That's the cliffhanger in this one, is why the hell is Denise Crosby on our screen again as a Romulan? That makes no sense. It's not the same kind of a cliffhanger. Instead of a, oh my god, what's going to happen? It's, oh my god, WTF?
What?
Yeah, it's a what? It's a what kind of cliffhanger? And then in part two, we get the resolution of all the Klingon Civil War and Data encounters android prejudice. Because they had to throw that in somehow. So, Rick, what are your thoughts on Redemption?
I love this episode. Hands down. With the possible exception of Sela, the first Star Trek convention I ever went to was a mini con. It was like a 1 day thing in Fort Lauderdale, and it actually ended up being more like a traveling vendor's room with a guest star, and that guest star was Denise Crosby. And oh, wow. My friend and I went to this, and we spent 45 minutes listening to her justify her bad career decisions. I'm sure she's a very lovely person. I'm sure she's very nice. She takes credit for the Sela character. I personally think that you don't want to take too much credit for that one. But at least in Redemption, the Sela character is interesting. It's later on when we get to Unification that it just goes straight down the tubes. I generally don't like Worf. And I've taken some flack for this. I don't think Michael Dorn does a bad job. It's just that Worf just seems to be there, at least in Next Gen. And in DS9, he gets more rounded. But in Next Gen, he just seems to be there for whatever badass alien comes on the ship in that week to throw him against a bulkhead and prove it's even, a bigger badass than he is. So it's like, yeah. Everything that comes on the ship kicks Worf's ass and then moves on.
I never thought of that.
But it's true. He's got a collection of dented bulkheads in his quarters. Oh, and this one was on Stardate 46424 when the Volgon came on. And
see, there's the outline of my ass right there.
And that's the time forehead. That my forehead pattern was actually embedded in the side of the bulkhead.
That being said, though, I love what Next Gen did with the Klingons. And this episode, you have Robert O'Reilly's Gowron. You have Worf doing really great stuff. You have Lursa and Betor, who are just amazingly evil. We haven't had that kind of seething evil since John Colicos in the original series from a Klingon.
Yeah.
Patrick Stewart just gets to absolutely let go. I love the scene with him when Lursa and Betor invite him to their house.
Yes, I love that scene. You can tell Picard wants to explode so much, but he has too much diplomatic savoir-faire to do it.
Oh,
but
and he just tears them apart.
He gets the point across without raising his voice. It's exactly. Wonderful.
We get Tony Todd as Kern, which Tony Todd, I'll watch him do anything. I think Tony Todd is amazing.
The best Sorogian in Voyage.
That's right, yeah. There's just, to me, aside, I don't think there's a bad moment in this episode, in both episodes. It all ties together so well. There's great repercussions, throughout the rest of the series. It sets up a lot of the what we know about the Klingon Empire. I love the resolution of the whole Duras thing because I don't hate to name drop. I love the fact Susie Plaxton is a friend of mine who played Kalar, Worf's wife, Alexander's mother.
By the way, I heard her first interview on the Starbase, and it was one of my favorite interviews I've ever heard. That you did a great job on that one.
Thank you. The fact that led to a friendship between Susie and I, just if nothing else ever happened from the Starbase, I would still be like, that was the best thing ever, because Susie's just wonderful. But the fact that she wasn't there for it, because obviously her character had been killed, but there was a resolution and some justice for what happened to Kalar. That was one thing that set TNG above TOS, and I don't often like to make the comparison, because it's kind of like saying, your grandfather sucks because he's not as developed as his son. People that crap on TOS but are fans of TNG, I think they're kind of missing the point of, without TOS, there would be no TNG.
Absolutely.
But one area where I think TNG really kind of broke some ground is in episodic television, especially in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the consequences were unheard of from one episode to another. In TOS, I think there's two mentions in any episode of something that happened previously. But TNG went out of their way to actually set up things and have them, Picard's assimilation and rescue from the Borg had consequences. Granted, it was just one episode, and then he was all better, but they still addressed it. And a lot of the stuff that happens in Redemption has echoes further on down the line in TNG and in DS9.
Yes, in both. I mean, the idea of the tumultuousness of the Klingon High Council is revisited again and again. Even in our next two-parter in Unification, Gowron has already started to eliminate the Enterprise from the narrative of his ascension to the throne, essentially.
Yep.
And that thread goes all the way until you get to the impersonation storyline on DS9 with the Changeling.
Yeah.
It builds and builds and builds to that point, which is one of the best long games that Star Trek did across the series. So I agree with you. The development of the Klingon politics, and it also stands out to me, because a lot of Next Gen, a lot of the episodes are science-based, exploration-based. If they're character-driven, it's not usually conflict-based. It's more about, understanding and exploration of the self, exploration of relationships. This is a politics episode. This is about the power play between the different factions in the Klingon Empire and in the Federation and in the Romulan Star Empire, whose allegiance is going to go where. This kind of storyline would not be out of place in a Game of Thrones type of universe. It's well constructed. Obviously, it's not as nearly as dark or as deadly as what we see today, but it would make sense in a show that would be on today, in how they create all the different political alliances. And I think, Josh, you might agree with that point.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's really, I've crossed out all of my notes because you guys have already said everything I would have said about this episode, but I just want to pile on and say that I love that this episode shows actually just how complicated Klingons are.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not just honor. I think in the first season it was just honor. They didn't flesh out. They're like, how can the Klingons be good but still be Klingons? And they're like, they're about honor and they're fighters and they get thrown against bulkheads. but by this point, you have, with Kalar and Duras, they've created this saga. And I almost feel like Worf episodes, if you put them all in a line and just watch the Worf episodes, it is almost like DS9 in that they kind of flow into each other with the Klingon storyline. Now, Worf, when he's on his own, like when he's back, injured his back, that one not so much. But if you look at the Klingon politics stories, they all fit together fairly nicely in the Next Gen. So
even going back to Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which actually is a great segue. I think we'll probably bring up Redemption again at the end, I'm thinking. So we'll segue again to Unification, which is the next two-parter. The first two-parter that occurred mid-season. It occurs in the middle of Season 5. And that Unification was actually released 1 month before The Undiscovered Country. Unification is Leonard Nimoy's cameo in The Next Generation, essentially. The first part is, where's Spock? And he's not wearing a red and white shirt, but where's Spock? And the second part is, oh, here's Spock, what is he doing? But you do have the Spock mentions in Unification Part 2 that he was responsible for what happened at Kittimer. But that was stated in the episode before Undiscovered Country came out. That was a teaser for the plot of Undiscovered Country, that something had happened at Kittimer that's not as straightforward as people might think, which we can get into Undiscovered Country. I think Josh and I, we both said that it's one of our favorites. It's actually one of the most underrated films of the bunch.
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
And I think that's true. Unfortunately, I don't think Unification lives up to that standard. It does some good things in Unification. I was entertained by the living conditions on board a bird of prey.
Yes.
But I think Unification has its flaws too. And
I didn't like this episode. I don't really have much good to say about it. The fact that you just told me, which I did not know, that it came out right before The Undiscovered Country came out and provided a teaser, that to me, in my honest opinion, is that is its one redeeming quality and it, its job. And I give it a D now. So I honestly, not much to say here. I did not enjoy it.
I mean, I have one saving grace for this episode, and that's that you have a slight addressing of the Sarek and Spock relationship.
Yes.
It should have been addressed more,
mm-hmm.
and it should have been addressed differently, but at least they address it and they don't just drop it, because they had mentioned it so much in Sarek, you know, in season 3. And,
oh my god, there's so much they could have done with Leonard Nimoy returning to a Star Trek series. It was a total swing and a miss.
Why did they place Leonard Nimoy's, all of his scenes on Romulus? I mean, I would have loved to have seen Nimoy on the bridge of the Enterprise D, even if just for one scene.
Yes.
You know, that would have been nice. Rick, do you think this is a case of squandered potential?
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. I think there's a lot of good in this episode. The fact that it's our last time with Mark Leonard as Sarek.
Yes.
We don't see Sarek again on screen, and you know they announce the character dies in the episode, and then Mark Leonard himself died not too long after this. So that's kind of a it was nice that they were able to get him back for one more turn, and they didn't sugarcoat it. You know, they didn't make it all nice and pretty. They showed that, you know, dying of old age is not pretty, and I really admire both the writers, the producers. One of the few things Rick Berman did that was right was letting that happen. And I admire Mark Leonard for being willing to do that.
And it sets up the idea of dementia being a malady in Vulcans that we saw again with Tuvok and then with T'Pol.
Yeah.
Enterprise. It set up that idea.
Like with Redemption, we're seeing more dimension to the Vulcans as a people, as opposed to just as, you know, Star Trek has often been criticized that the aliens are kind of like one note, you know, Klingons are angry, Romulans are scheming, you know, this race only does this, this race only does that, every planet has one environment, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's nice to see them fleshing out the Vulcans and showing that they don't always just, you know, they do lose their faculties, they do lose their logic. It was nice to see Perrin again.
Yes.
The expression on Spock's face when he mind melds with Picard in the last second of the episode is heartbreaking.
Yes.
You know, so I love the scenes on board the Klingon bird of prey, like you said. The guy, I forget the actor's name that played the Klingon captain, but he was having so much fun. Just absolutely messing with Picard and Data.
We do not cushion where we sleep.
Or what was it you were saying to Data? You know, be wary, be careful, unless some Romulan lady gets too close and tries to lick that paint off your ear.
Yes.
I don't dislike this one. I think that this is where the Sela character really just completely falls apart, because Denise Crosby, I kind of get what she was going for. She was trying to make her a little less Romulan than the Romulans, while still being Romulan, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
But it just it just felt too familiar. And then she was just incredibly stupid, leaving them all in her office with full access to computer terminals.
Dumb.
Yeah, and
dumb.
So
you're leaving a computer in charge of a computer.
Yeah.
That has holodeck capabilities. Wow.
Yeah. But the, you know, that being said, the scene between Picard and Sela was nice, where, you know, and I don't think I have a problem in the concept of, you know, how they took yesterday's Enterprise and ran with it, and you know, the story of how Sela was born and how Tasha dies, it's, you know, that's some well acted stuff. But yeah, I have to agree, overall this episode, these episodes, it's kind of a hot mess.
And I think my other complaint with this episode, in part one, I was actually intrigued by the plot line of what happened to the Vulcan freighter. I was intrigued by the mystery of it, and I was hoping...
Oh, yeah, the freight yard.
I was hoping that it was going to lead to something quite substantial. That, you know, yes, it turns out to be part of Sela's plot, you know, the invasion force or whatever, but it's really amorphous. I was really hoping that that ship or something like it was going to be integral to resolving part of the plot or setting up something down the road. Maybe it's a flagship. Maybe it was what got Spock to Romulus in the first place. But it has all this buildup for that storyline and all this intrigue and nothing. And I think what most disappointed me is the ship that they encounter in the junkyard that gets destroyed because it's carrying so much weaponry. We never learn anything substantial about it at all. And this is a small ship, but Geordi says that their weapons complement could easily match ours. We never see this ship design again, but I would be intrigued to see a ship that's that much smaller than a galaxy-class starship that could defeat it in battle, that only lost because it had so much unstable cargo. We don't know what alien had it. We don't know who built it. I would like to learn more about it as an interesting, like, a mercenary race. Was it the Orions? Because, I mean, the Orions could have been potentially a force that could have had a ship like that. They're pirates. They work for hire. Maybe they should have gone that route. It would have been entertaining to see TNG's take on the Orions. But no, there's no follow-up on it at all. It's just dropped.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll grant you that was a lost opportunity. But I think that, you know, I'm thinking back over all of the things that happened in the episode. They were already cramming too much into the episode.
I wonder if it would have been better pacing wise if they would have met Spock halfway through part one and given him a little more time with some of the characters.
Well, it's one of those things where they tried to set up a mystery and some tension, but there was no way in hell anybody bought the idea that Spock was defecting to the Romulans.
No.
And so the fact that he was on Romulus. Because, you know, I remember when this episode aired and they're like, oh, is he defecting? And we're like, no, no way. And so it was not in any way a revelation when we found out he was there trying to unify, you know, well, there's the title of the episode.
Giveaway right there.
Yeah. You know,
I think it was actually called Unification 1. So you knew it was going to be a two part.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't disagree that this episode was a bit of a miss. I may be a little more forgiving of it than y'all are.
I think it's not a bad episode, and I will say, a bad episode of TNG is better than 90% of anything else.
Oh, hell yeah.
Absolutely.
It's just not one of my favorites. I think that's... Is that fair, Josh, is what you would say?
Yeah, sure.
This is Josh from the future, or at least from later than when we recorded this part. You see, this episode actually goes on for about another hour. We went 2 full hours discussing the best 2-parters of The Next Generation. Based on a Twitter poll held at B&Q Podcast, we have determined that this episode is going to be split into 2 parts. You have just listened to part 1, and next week we'll release part 2, where we will analyze the rest of the TNG 2-parters and tell you which 2-parter stands supreme. We hope you enjoyed this first part of the episode featuring Rick from the Starbase 66 podcast, Admiral Marius. We thank him again and hope you'll like listening next week. So for Josh, JP, as he'll be known in the future, and myself, thank you very much from B&Q. Jar Jar survives tonight, but not for long. to be continued.
Mr. Worf.